We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with local, and we have a levy coming up, a school levy.
Yeah, for folks who haven't been following things and were surprised to see them getting a ballot in the mail this week, it is for two propositions in the city of Seattle, for the Seattle School District, Proposition 1 and 2, which are the operating levies. One is for general expenses, and the other is a capital levy. Those are renewals of existing levies. The operating one is for 3 years, 2014 and 2016, for $550 million, and the capital one is for 6 years, through the year 2019, about $700 million total. And as we often do, we offer suggestions for how to vote on this, and I'm inclined to vote in favor of operating levies unless there's something really egregiously wrong with them for the schools, because the public schools have to be funded. And if you look at the opposition for these levies, it either comes from anti-tax folks who just don't like the idea of paying for anything, or it comes from people who quite legitimately have problems with the way the Seattle School District itself is managed. We can go through a laundry list of what some of those programs are. And even with a new superintendent, you still have the same dubiously effective school board and a lot of issues that have come up over the last operating levy period. But a couple of things. Number one, that's an issue for needing better school board candidates, not for denying operating funds. What has happened, and this happened a couple times in the 90s, is that when voters get angry with the way the school district is being operated and reject the levies, they have to have that money, so they just come back and keep submitting it to a vote until it passes. It happened, I think, like four times once in the early 90s before
which turns out to be a waste of taxpayer money.
It's a total waste of money because they're not significantly changing the levies. They need the same amount of money. They might do some window dressing to try and make it more palatable to anti-tax people, but it really is going to keep passing or being voted on until it passes.
Well, and with the lack of funding from the federal government and from the state, which needed a state Supreme Court decision to tell the state legislature, look, you got to pour at least another $1 billion into school funding.
And they're probably not going to do it anyway this year.
Yeah. And when that's the case, then it really comes down to local folks having to pay for your local schools. And it's hard to argue that that's not a good expense or not a good use of taxpayer money.
Yeah. So for folks who are concerned about how the Seattle school districts are operated, show up at school board meetings, run for school board, support people who are running for school board who would bring real change.
Do something.
Do something more than casting a no vote that won't lead anywhere.
Yeah. All right. So we're recommending people vote for the
yes,
school
levies. That's a yes vote.
In case you didn't get that.
At the same time, we have an update. I talked a couple of weeks ago about teachers at Garfield announcing that they would no longer administer the MAP test, which is given to ninth graders, I believe, in at Garfield, and a number of reasons having to do with the ineffectiveness and the lack of applicability to what students are actually studying and use of the computer labs, taking up a lot of time away from people who actually are trying to learn the curriculum.
And whether teaching kids to the test has any real value.
The Garfield students, our teachers actually
students.
Were very clear that they were not opposed to testing per se. What they were opposed to was this particular test.
Yeah.
They had no problem with the new statewide replacement for the WASL, for example, which by all accounts is actually much more relevant than the WASL was to what students are studying. Mm-hmm. Over the past couple of weeks, we've had a couple more student schools join in that boycott. Orca Elementary and Salmon Bay, which I believe is K-8, actually.
I thought Orca was more elementary too. Orca was K-12 or something.
Oh, okay. In any event, they have added themselves on, and it's interesting because the Garfield teachers were specifically saying that this test may work for younger students, but by the time they get to high school, it really isn't relevant. And these other schools are saying, well, actually, for younger students, it's not a great idea either.
Mm-hmm.
And the discouraging part so far is that even with the new superintendent Banda having come in, the administration of the Seattle School District continues to be not very responsive to the concerns of teachers, to the concerns of parents, et cetera. In this case, Superintendent Banda having the school sending out letters to the teachers, basically saying that that teachers who refuse to administer the test are liable for suspension, which is a fairly empty threat because you cannot suspend an entire school's faculty. Particularly ironic given that one of the criticisms of the test is that it takes time away from classroom time for teaching. See how much classroom time for teaching there is when you have no teachers in a school. In the case of Garfield, you also had a number of the administrators, the students themselves also in favor of the refusal to administer the test. So it's going to be very interesting to see where it goes, but it is picking up support from there have been a number of schools who've passed resolutions in support of the refusal, and it's getting quite a bit of national attention as well. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
All right. Moving on, this week they did the annual King County count of those who are homeless.
Yeah, that was Thursday night into Friday morning. 2,736 was the exact number that King County came up with, because, of course, bureaucracies love exact numbers of people who were homeless this week. And that sounds like a lot of people. In fact, it's up 5.5% from a year ago. But it's also a dramatic undercount. They've made more of an effort in recent years to keep count people who are sleeping in cars, but people sleeping in cars are by definition mobile, and they're by definition going to places where they might not easily be found. But even that doesn't count people who do couch surfing, people who, you know, might spend two or three nights a week in a motel. They have some money, just not enough money to afford first and last on a place to live and so forth. The actual number you're seeing is probably quite a bit higher, particularly among young adults. You know, for all the various causes of homelessness, a lot of them are fairly stable from year to year. Substance abuse, mental health, disability, domestic violence, or family issues. But the one that really directly changes is the economy. And the economy can affect all those other things, too. But we're seeing in particular the youth unemployment and the unemployment of non-whites being stagnant or continually getting worse. And some of those rates are very high. And that's being directly affected by directly affecting the number of people on the streets. The other thing that's directly affecting the number of people on the streets, and Maria's talked about this quite a bit, is rapidly rising rental prices in the Seattle area and the continuing
lack of availability of rental units.
Well, and not just rental units in general, but the continued erosion of affordable housing, mm-hmm. and, you know, having older homes and older apartment buildings that are more affordable continually being torn down, often with assistance from the city in the form of tax credits and permits
build,
and whatnot, to build new, quote-unquote, market-rate housing, which is completely unaffordable.
Extremely high now.
Yeah, completely unaffordable to somebody who's working class or unemployed. So,
or just starting out.
So, the one-night count is used for a lot of funding decisions at the city and county level. But, again, it's dramatically undercounted in a lot of ways. And people should remember that when they look at the amount of resources that are and are not being directed to help giving people, helping people first find shelter and then transition into more permanent housing.
Yeah. One of those housing units was Yesler Terrace, which I saw this week. Just got they're giving the contract to Vulcan to rebuild
that.
Yeah,
and I think
I'm shocked. Shocked I am.
I think it was a little bit of local favoritism there.
Mm. You think? you think the fact that the Yesler Terrace was basically decided about a year before any public hearings were held had anything to do with Vulcan's lobbyists?
All right. Well, speaking of billionaires.
billionaires who own sports teams, no less.
Update on basketball.
We talked a little bit last week about the rumors surrounding the sale of the Sacramento Kings to Chris Hansen, the hedge fund manager who and his partners who want to buy the Sacramento Kings and relocate them here to Seattle and put them in a third arena to be constructed in the SoDo part of Seattle. This week it appears that it is a mostly done deal. However, there are some things standing in the way of it. Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson says he is putting together a counteroffer, trying to get together some local billionaires in Sacramento.
Johnson, by the way, a former
make a counteroffer.
Johnson's a former NBA player, by the way, so he's very vested.
He's a former NBA All-Star.
Trying to keep the basketball team in Seattle.
Yeah.
And Sacramento.
And there's a lawsuit now from a minority owner of the Sacramento Kings who says that the agreement, the ownership agreement for the Sacramento Kings, the Maloofs were the Maloof family owned, I believe, 53%. Another owner who was selling owned 12%. So Hansen and Company would be buying 65% of the team. There are other minority owners involved. The ownership agreement has it set up as a limited partnership. And one of the minority owners filed a lawsuit this week saying that the limited partners have a right of first refusal to buy the team if one partner wants to sell. That can only be settled through arbitration, a settlement, or a court decision. So we'll see where that goes. However, I think Chris Hansen might also end up stepping in and offering to buy out those minority partners at the inflated price that he's offered the Maloof family. This could be the reason behind that lawsuit. The minority partners could be saying, well, hey, you know, dude, if you made an offer to buy the team at a 75% premium to the majority owner, then we want a part of that deal.
Yeah, or they might, Hansen might have offered something to them already and they're trying to drive up the price.
Yeah, could be. But there are two other lawsuits locally here that could also throw a spanner in the works. There's the ILWU lawsuit that is saying the city has to do a full environmental impact statement for the arena. That hasn't happened yet. And they need to also look at some alternative sites for it, which hasn't been a part of the deal. And the second lawsuit, which I talked about last week, that the agreement violates the initiative that was passed in 2006 that says any new arena built with city money has to turn a profit for the city, not just for the private owners of the arena, as this current agreement does. So those are also potential roadblocks for Hansen and Company bringing the Sacramento Kings up to Seattle.
All right. Update on transportation issues.
Yeah, there's a little update on some of the transportation issues that I talked about last week. Last week I mentioned that the city of Seattle spends only about one quarter of what's needed to fix its roads and bridges. Well, there's also some data, too, in terms of transit funding that I thought was kind of interesting. A group of transit agencies and activists are going to be forming a new lobbying group in Olympia this year to try to get the state to put more money into transit funding. It turns out that Washington State only contributes about 2% to local transit funding to the various transit agencies in this state. Nationally, the average is much higher. For other states, the average is 22%. So the fact that Washington State only funds transit to about 2% is, I think, a real scandal. But good luck getting the money out of this year's legislature with the what do you call that somewhat Republican majority in the Senate?
Disaster area.
Disaster. Yes, it's a mess.
All right. Speaking of disaster areas,
yeah. One of the ways in which that is dysfunctional, and we talked about this sort of thing happening, over the past month, came to fruition in the state Senate this week. The Family Paid Leave Act, the bill passed in 2007, but has never actually been funded to enable the state to reimburse employers who need to give employees time off for family paid leave for various reasons.
When a new child is born.
Yeah,
or a temporary
disability or whatever it might be. The original sponsor, Senator Kerrion Kaiser from Kent, has introduced a bill this year to actually fund it and to expand the coverage of it. And the new quote-unquote Democratic Senate Majority Leader, Rodney Thom, who basically along with one other conservative Democrat, has empowered the Republican majority. He voted in favor of the Family Leave Act in 2007. Now he has signed on to a separate bill that would, in fact, repeal it instead. Because Thom is controlling a Republican majority, there are also Republican heads for all the different committees where bills are heard. And as I talked about, that's where the real damage is being done, because it decides which bills are going to be heard and which bills are not. So Moses Lake Republican Holmquist Newbury is the chairwoman of the Commerce and Labor Committee, where the Family Paid Leave Act bills would be heard. And guess what? The repeal bill is going to receive a hearing, and Kaiser's bill to actually fund something the state legislature has already passed and has already been assigned a bill won't even receive a hearing. That's the difference between we don't have the dollars to fund it this year because of revenue shortfalls, and let's eliminate it for all time as in terms of an approach. Yeah. We're looking at a lot of social safety net things being eliminated. And by the way, not having it during budget shortfall, thanks to Iman for that, because we can't raise revenues, yeah. And there's a structural reason for
this
that.
This is after Rodney Toms said that the Senate's focus this year was going to be on budget issues, not on these kinds of social issues.
Yeah, and he said specifically that he didn't want to see the social safety net damaged. And meanwhile, he's signing on to bills and empowering committee chairs that are trying to do exactly that. The new governor, Jay Inslee, has said he does not support repeal, so chances are they can't get it passed, but that's what the Senate is spending time on. Welcome to gridlock.
Mm-hmm. All right. On to national, starting with the filibuster reform.
Yeah, Harry Reid, U.S. Senate Majority Leader, backed off from filibuster reform efforts this week and agreed to a deal with Senate Republicans that basically involve cosmetic changes. It does not change the need to have a 60-vote majority in order to pass anything in the Senate. And for that reason, you're not likely to see anything go through the Senate for the next couple of years, because the Republicans are very likely to do exactly what they did over the past four years, which is to block everything with a 40-some vote minority.
I can't get my head around the fact that when the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate, they rarely used the filibuster, and here they are, they're the majority in the Senate, and they can't see their way to filibuster reform, to getting rid of the tool that the Republicans have been using against them for 2 years now.
Yeah, well, 4 years, and for that matter, when Republicans were the minority, through much of the 20th century, they never used the filibuster like this either. This is a very modern mm-hmm. phenomenon, creating gridlock in government. And, you can make an argument that Reid hasn't said this, but it's like, well, as long as the Republicans control the House, we're not going to get anything through the House anyway, so why spend the political capital on filibuster reform now as opposed to when the Democrats hold the House as well? But that doesn't take into account the value of things passing through the Senate and the value of forcing the issue in terms of public dialogue.
And there are
exactly what the Republicans are doing, and the Democrats have public opinion on their side on most of these issues.
Yeah, and there are some things that pass only through the Senate, like the confirmation of nominations that has been in a complete standstill for 4 years.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, apparently, everyone's sitting down. Apparently, there was some good news coming out of D.C. this week.
Yeah, there was a little bit of good news this week. The NIH announced that it will retire chimpanzees from its research facilities. It has about 451 chimpanzees, which will be removed eventually to sanctuaries, but they will begin right away to evaluate which ones can be retired. Only a small colony of about 50 chimpanzees will be kept for possible future research, but an independent committee that will include members of the public will have to review those requests for any of them to be used in the future. The NIA is going to immediately cancel 6 biomedical projects that currently use chimpanzees. So it would be nice. That's a great first step, and it's good news for folks who keep track of the ethical use of animals in research. Now we hope the NIH will take the lead in looking at reviewing research for monkeys, which are used much more widely in medical research and other great apes.
Mm-hmm. All right. And speaking
of medical research, there's been a lot of things in the news over the past couple of weeks talking about new and more modern and effective flu vaccines coming on the market in the next year or two, because it's been a particularly bad season this year for flus. And what they're talking about is vaccines they're in the limited market, in the limited areas this year, will probably be more widely available by next year. But And within the next handful of years, they'll have vaccines that, that cover all flus, not just varieties that they can select well ahead of time, far enough ahead of time that they can go through the current process to make those vaccines. And also, they would be vaccines that are permanently effective or effective for very long periods of time, as opposed to having to get a new shot every year. What has not been in a lot of those news stories is how that research has taken place. That's basically been NIH funding. It's been government funding, not private funding. Big pharma companies have been very reluctant to do research into new vaccines of any kind because they're not nearly as profitable as, oh, say, erectile dysfunction drugs or some of their other profit centers.
And they want to keep selling, you know, largely ineffective cold and flu medicines.
Yeah. So so in 2006, the Health and Human Services Department provided more than $1 billion. In contracts through the NIH to six manufacturers to develop cell-based as opposed to the current egg-based flu vaccine technologies. And in 2009, they gave Novartis nearly $500 million to build the first U.S. facility capable of producing cell-based vaccines for seasonal and pandemic flus in the U.S. That's what's coming online now, $1.5 billion investment. And mind you, those were in budgets approved through the Bush administration for 2006 and the fiscal year 2009. And instead, what we have is Senate Minority Whip Eric Cantor introducing a bill this past week that would cut $1.3 billion this year alone from the NIH budget, specifically targeting toward medical research, saying that should be something private companies should do.
No.
So $1.5 billion investment by the government.
Exactly in that, the reverse.
Yeah, $1.5 billion investment from the government, which you know, saved a lot of lives for one thing, saved, you know, a lot of healthcare costs and saved, you know, a huge, unfathomable numbers of billions of dollars in lost productivity in the economy, once those vaccines come online. And the Republicans want to cut it because, you know, government is bad or something. It's just unfathomable.
All right. Also this week, Dianne Feinstein.
I just briefly want to talk about it being Women's Week in the military this week. The Pentagon lifted its ban on women in combat, which actually is really retitling some of the combat-related jobs that women are already filling. But what it will have the effect of doing is increasing pay and opportunities for promotion for women in the military. But of course, it won't happen immediately. The Pentagon is allowing 3 years until January of 2016 for each of the various service branches to make a final decision about each different type of job, whether or not they will allow women to do them.
It's because they're still so busy trying to deal with the horrible effects of allowing gays to serve openly in the military.
Yeah, and this came the same week as General Mark Welsh, the Air Force Chief of Staff, told Congress that the Air Force had an appalling, and that was his own language, an appalling number of sexual assault reports in 2012, 2 years after the first reports of abuse at Lackland Air Force Base, where all Air Force recruits go through basic training. So far, the Air Force's own investigation has found 32 instructors at Lackland who were involved in inappropriate or coercive sexual relationships, including rape. 32 instructors, only six of whom have so far been court-martialed.
Isn't this the same Air Force that has been having a problem for a number of years ago with being suffused with evangelical Christians that being forced on recruits and whatnot?
Yeah, and General Welsh said this year 796 reports have been made of sexual assault in the Air Force. That's a 30% increase over 2011, and it's been increasing every year. This is just unacceptable. But, you know, it's rampant in the military. It being Women's Week there, you'd think there'd be more talk of this in the media that while women are being allowed to serve in combat roles, on the other hand, they're also being terribly and sexually exploited in the military.
Yeah, and the problem's been getting steadily worse for several years. It's not just reporting issues. It's also a culture of violence.
It is.
And one of the impacts of permanent war.
And of devaluing women.
All right. Did you want to touch on Dianne Feinstein's assault?
Yeah, Dianne Feinstein stepped forward and said, well, no one else is doing it, so here we go. I'm introducing an assault weapons ban. Her assault weapons ban is very specifically worded to ban 157 types of semi-automatic weapons and magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. This would allow about 900 gun models to be exempt for hunting and sports shooting. And, of course, it does not prevent gun manufacturers from getting around her assault weapons ban by manufacturing new models of guns that would fly under the radar. But kudos to her for actually doing it, since no one else has done it yet.
All right. Gives us 3 minutes left for international, starting with the UN and drones.
Yeah, the UN Human Rights Council announced this week that it will investigate drone strikes in the war on terror, quote, with a view to determining whether there is a plausible allegation of unlawful killing, end quote. It will look at 25 drone strikes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and the Palestinian territories, which means not just the U.S. will be in their focus, but also U.K. and Israel.
Using U.S.-built weapons.
But in typically careful language, the U.N. hopes to determine, quote, the circumstances in which drone strike targeted killings are lawful and on safeguards necessary to protect civilians, end quote. So the goal is not to ban drone strikes altogether.
Also, sentencing in U.S. federal court?
Yeah, this week a major international terrorist was sentenced in U.S. federal district court in Chicago. Was it a detainee in Guantanamo? Oh, no. It was a white guy, David C. Headley, an American double agent who helped Lashkar-e-Taiba conduct and coordinate the 2008 terrorist attacks in Mumbai, India. He got 35 years in prison this week. This came after U.S. government lawyers urged the judge in the case, very strongly urged him not to sentence Headley to life in prison, seek the death penalty, or extradite him to Pakistan, India, or Denmark.
Yeah, why is he, given that the crime was committed in India, why was he not being tried in India or Pakistan?
He should have been, but because he has served as an agent for U.S. intelligence and has given them what they call valuable secret information about terrorist groups, he gets not a free pass, but a pretty cushy 35 years compared to the death penalty, would have received if he'd been extradited to India.
He probably would have received it here if he had been Muslim.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that six of the victims in the Mumbai attacks were U.S. citizens, and that several children were killed in those attacks.
And Israel.
Very briefly, since we're running out of time, Israel's elections were last weekend, and Prime Minister Netanyahu did win. There was a lot in the media about how narrowly he won his majority, a bare majority in the Knesset, which is his Israeli parliament, with which to form a new government among the conservative parties there. But what was not left unsaid by many of those news reports is it won't really matter functionally, particularly in terms of how the West Bank is treated, the fact that Israel continues to expand settlements to make the facts on the ground make it impossible for there to be a two-state solution, and to be in defiance of much of the international community. That is not going to change unless Netanyahu is out of power. It has not changed in the past when he has had a narrow majority in Israel. The only thing that's going to change it, as long as he is in power, is sustained pressure from the United States as well as the rest of the international community. And so far, the U.S., of course, remains wildly out of step with the rest of the international community in its willingness to enable Israel's crimes.
Events.
Thursday, January 31st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Common Good Cafe, Randy Mandel will be speaking on debt bubbles and money in politics. That's at the University Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Street Northeast in the U District. And that was also, speaking of assault weapons and guns, there's a buyback program.
Yes, there's a gun buyback program today, in fact, under Interstate 5 downtown between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. in the parking lot between Cherry and James Streets at 600 7th Avenue. So here's the advice. If you do turn in your guns at the gun buyback, you can get gift cards in exchange for them, but you should lock your guns in the trunk of your car. Do not carry them openly with you in the front of your vehicle. And when you get there, wait until you have the attention of a police officer before you open your trunk. Do not take your weapons out and wave them around.
Yeah, and they should. I would expect you to be unloaded and with the magazine out, too.
Yes, yes. And you know, if you have a gun and you live in an urban area, I really don't think you need one. This is your opportunity to turn it in.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my back articles at mariatomczyk.com.